Welcome to the second episode of the University of Oxford's COP29 podcast series on sustainable cities. My name is Dr. Catherine Maxwell, and today I'll be speaking with Professor Mikael Akuto, Pro Vice Chancellor of Global Engagement at the University of Bristol. We'll be discussing how cities are developing partnerships to accelerate towards their net zero targets. Welcome to the podcast, Mikael. Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Let's jump in then. At COP29 this year, there's been a significant focus on national governments' climate targets. However, there's also an increasing emphasis on implementing climate action at the city scale. So this has been seen at COP29 and also other UN conferences such as the recent World Urban Forum. So with this in mind, how has this year's COP and other UN climate conferences really started to recognise the increasing role of cities within climate negotiations?
Yeah, good question. It's been a few COPs for cities, to say the least. So I think it's a good point in a trajectory of many, many things. And I think you're perfectly right there. It's COP plus many, many other things. So if you are a city or if you're in, let's say, the city diplomacy space, a city network, a multilateral organization like the World Bank or others that work with cities, you've got a pretty busy year, almost every year at this point. I think COP specifically this year, up until now, we've seen lots of mayors, lots of city networks really engaged, really part of conversations, tons of side events, tons of advocacy, tons of reporting on it. So if anything, it's very clear the cities are there in not just the machinery of COP, but the broader multilateral world of climate action. The advantage has been that this, like the previous COP now, even has a dedicated day for this kind of conversation. And I think I'm happy to, so we can dwell a bit more into that, but that's sort of an interesting part of being formally part of this. But I'd say it's pretty hard to imagine a COP now without mayors and city advocates on the stage.
Mm-hmm. And with this sort of increasing role over the past few years, how have these sort of negotiations and engaging in these negotiations influenced how cities collaborate with multiple different stakeholders and partners on climate action?
Yeah, I think a couple of things to unpack there potentially. On the one hand, my international law self reminds itself that cities are not a party per se to the negotiation itself. At the end of the day, in many of these contexts, we're still talking about international process and programs. So practically, even when we speak of city diplomats, we have to remind ourselves that there are national diplomats that are the ones engaged in the negotiation itself. So I think something important, and my alluding to other COPs, is I had flashes this morning thinking to the COP news of the Copenhagen COP quite a while back. And my memory was always, okay, our city is always outside of the tent. And there's a reference that there was a ditch in a tent at that point of city action outside of Copenhagen's main negotiation. And I think cities are now in the tent insofar as there is a recognition, there is a day, there are many national diplomats that work with and through cities. Mm-hmm. And there are many bodies, international bodies that have embraced cities. There are many elements of these international bodies within the UN, for instance, where cities can fit in. The interesting thing is, do cities have a say in the negotiation per se, which they don't, but they have an important role in the lobbying and the pushing and the shifting of those negotiations. Mm-hmm. And that, I think the last for me is, importantly in there is, we always focus a lot on mayors, and there's lots to be said about mayors and the city leaders. But if we think of city leaders a bit more broadly, there's many other city leadership that is coming from all over the place. Major philanthropies, as I said, multilateral organizations, coalitions of cities. So you have many realities that might not be the mayor that you see on stage, but they're very powerful urban actors. So I think the qualifier for me is we've seen a more and more mature, a more and more present, and more successful urban conversation. And I'd say we can still say oftentimes it's more successful than the national conversation by quite some degree.
Okay. And that's really interesting, because as these international climate negotiations move towards discussions around climate action implementation and financing climate action, how does that then impact the types of partnerships that cities are currently developing? And do you think this is going to encourage cities to sort of think outside the box and partner with stakeholders and organizations that they wouldn't normally or traditionally engage with?
I think controversially, I would say the cities have been thinking outside of that box for quite some time now. And in many ways, the genesis of things that you would know very well, like the genesis of C40, being a C20, as in a G20 of cities back quite a few decades, a couple of decades now at this point, although a decade, it sort of reminds you that cities had to think outside of the box because the national box wasn't delivering. So I'm actually thinking it in reverse, that there's many more actors internationally that are thinking outside of the box, going via and with cities to deliver what they have to deliver to get to a plausible at least 2 degrees context and to really make change happen. Because practically then you see the wealth of evidence now that it's available, it's communicated through groups like Hickley and C40, where cities have delivered the action. You have tens of thousands of actions and hundreds of reports that show the level of action on the ground by cities. So in many ways, cities become one of the interesting implementers of the sort of global ambition. And I think structurally that's quite interesting, in the sense that then they become more fundamental actors and fundamental pieces of the puzzle to connect different things like philanthropic investment to business commitments on the ground, to planning and housing issues, to leadership and political positions. The city as a microcosm of action becomes a very interesting connector to think outside of a box, because at the end of the day, we're making still reasonably glacial steps forward into the fight against climate change.
And if cities have been kind of thinking outside the box for, you know, quite a number of years already, how can cities effectively kind of foster cross-sectoral collaboration in terms to meet their very ambitious, you know, climate mitigation and resilience commitments? Like, does this require a bit more of a concerted effort from cities to resource that type of engagement?
It does. In many ways, the evaluation of the success, I would argue, of things like of city networks points that, first of all, coalition really delivers. So the mode of collaborative urban governance, that's very academic as a term, but cities getting together with peers and doing stuff across borders, it has been proven by research to deliver the ambition and the activity on the ground. So the more you collaborate, the more likely you are to deliver at scale on climate change. So clearly the edifice that has been constructed and the skeleton that has been constructed internationally for city diplomacy by cities is delivering. The downside of that is that cities are on the front line of financial austerities and limits. And the reality there is that probably is a need for sizable national investment in cities. So I think thinking through this year's COP, one of the positives of last year's COP was the signing of CHAMP as a coalition for multi-level action that recognizes the need for countries to work with things like cities, and finally us getting to a stage where countries saying we can't deliver this without cities. This year there's been a recommitment to it, with obviously a Baku badge on top of it as a statement continuing the ambition of CHAMP. But we still struggle in the, I guess, oftentimes the national buy-in and the national plug-in for cities. And we still have a reality where we need very sizable investments. So I guess one fact is, for instance, mayors from C40 cities called for an $800 billion investment in cities by 2030. So the reality is we need really sizable multilateral and national investment in cities, and that still isn't happening at the scale we needed.
And do you think that, so people listening to the podcast might think, okay, you know, cities are putting resources behind this engagement, whether that's through networks such as C40 or ICLEI, because that can help mobilise resources and build a lot of momentum in kind of representing the city's sort of voice in these types of negotiations, even if there's not a formal process to always capture that contribution. I'm wondering if people will question the real benefits, though, of this kind of cross-sectoral collaboration. I mean, you touched upon there that, you know, there's a sizable investment that's required within cities to really deliver on their climate ambitions, many of which are hugely ambitious. But what are the kind of other benefits of this in terms of either city-to-city collaboration or collaborating with the private sector? You know, could you maybe list a couple of those in terms of from your experience of working with cities?
Yeah, I think the one advantage of this year's COP being the finance COP, whether it really delivers on that or not, is that a COP itself got on the same page of something that I would argue it's been a good few COPs that the cities and climate advocacy coalitions have been arguing for. So real serious financial instruments to deliver at that scale. I recall one piece of work that we had done jointly with C40 for the Paris Agreement was to prove a project called Powers and the power that cities had to deliver climate change. And the argument was cities were putting their money where their mouth was. So they were investing in these things. It isn't just mayors talking, it's mayors doing, but also that the debt had gotten to a level where it really needed higher scale investment to be really inclusive. And it's fundamentally still the issue, which is certain cities can do this, but they need their countries to bring along the variety of cities and urban realities that we have. And also that it isn't just about getting out there, it's about networking with each other to exchange policy experiences that work in one place and could work in another one. So you don't always have to start from scratch. Very practically, joint procurement, pool procurement, joint investments. So putting resources together, it's easier to invest in a number of cities than it is in a single one to see scale of change. And then practically also to create a sort of better coalition that has a voice of cities in the international context, because the international context for a long time just hasn't had a voice of cities in it. So I think something quite powerful there is that as COPs were sort of happening on one side, we had the G20 happening on the other side, and the finance ministers and the finance conversation really buying into the power of cities. There is an urban 20 attached to the group of 20 that put together a really sensible, powerful communique, and the G20 listening and engaging with it, that the multilateral agencies like the World Bank and other large banks have recognized the need and the complications of lending directly to cities, not just to states. So there's a lot of interesting experimentation there, but it isn't just the mayors out there doing canapes and it's not a branding exercise, it's a financing, it's a policy solutions kind of exercise. But it's hard. It's very hard from a mayoral perspective to explain that to your citizens that have so many other priorities and concerns, that it's really a return of that two-level game between your local politics and the international politics. And many, many mayors would tell you really horror stories, to be honest, about sort of how much you get into the fiery line for getting out there.
And that actually just touches upon my next point, because if we take the flip side of that in terms of some of the challenges which you've kind of touched upon a bit around climate action implementation, when, you know, cities are coming together and when there's an opportunity to invest in multiple cities at once to get the scale of change that you're kind of looking for. When cities are collaborating either with each other around investment or around knowledge sharing or sharing ideas on different types of policies that either are effective or not quite as effective, you know, this there can always be a risk, I suppose, of working with a stakeholder, and that can be across any sector, either with vested interests or maybe that has an influence that might not always align with a city's own climate vision and targets. So how do cities manage that? And is that even possible, working with a variety of different stakeholders, all with their different priorities and preferences?
Yeah, without naming names and pointing specific examples, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And it partly that's why I'm sort of referencing the idea of city diplomacy. So the idea that a city can do international relations, because most cities are an organized political entity and most cities have representatives out there. The interesting thing, and I'm thinking sort of through the work that we've done with the city diplomacy survey since 2017, where we're looking at cities internationally and trying to figure out, but can a city do this? Is this even the job of a city? Or is it the job of a city, I guess, in the English-speaking world, rates, roads and rubbish, right? That's all that they have to do as a city. And the argument has always been doing international relations is and external relations is fundamental to the life of a city, because a city is nothing but an aggregation of things that come together. At cities were born to be places of coming together, so you have to manage that coming together. And the reason why I say you hit the nail on the head is, yes, but most people and most cities, most people that work in cities and most cities don't really have structures for this, because we've progressively created cities less as city states and more as cities. You don't really have many city diplomats, right? So you don't really have many people trained to spot those sort of things. Trained to spot foreign interference and influence, trained in international negotiation. For me, it's always clear when we talk around COP, in the simple dance of who gets a badge and it goes into which room. And fundamentally, it's state diplomats can get into certain rooms and cities can't. Mm-hmm. So structurally, so expanding the international relations capacity of cities is not a vanity project or a side bit. It's 101 21st century municipal statecraft. It's the fundamentals of how we should be managing cities. The positives are that there are many cities out there that have gotten this, and they have really amazing international teams, because it isn't just the mayor getting up there. The positives is that there's more data about this, so you can disentangle all these actors, all these things happening and so on. The positives is that there's a generation of city profession or municipal professionals that now take things like C40 and networks as a default, so they're used to it. They're used to relying on their embassies when they go abroad. That's a classic thing that we always test. Do you know you can call your embassy because you're part of a country? But there's still a lot of work to do. And in reverse, and I guess I'm happy to get into that, but in reverse, countries are still not used to their cities being out there. So countries themselves, there's a handful of countries that have offices in their foreign ministries that deal with cities. We continuously imagine cities as road rates and rubbish bathed in a single place.
And actually, just picking up on that, the interesting dynamic then between local and national governments, as you know, cities do become a little bit more prominent or visible in some of these UN conferences such as COP. And do you think that these sort of partnerships and the sort of visibility, do you think that's kind of changing the role of cities within climate change negotiations? Now, as I mentioned before, we're aware that they don't have a formal way to feed into that process. But do you think the increased visibility is really strengthening cities or the urban sort of position on the global stage?
It is. It certainly has gotten quite a good size of what we could call sort of symbolic power, of bringing the city. And symbolic power isn't just being on stage. It is being able to identify the role of something in a mass of similar things. It would be odd, I think, these days to organize something like COP without those coalitions on the ground. So for instance, calls during this COP to either ditch the COP format or change it radically, I would expect it to really need an even greater sort of system for cities to feed in, to buy in, to engage, to respond, and so on. One of the important things is that we've brought in a section of it that engages with ministers that have to do with this. But there's still many countries where there isn't even a minister that deals with this sort of issues, right? There isn't an obvious interlocutor to cities. And I guess my reference to the handful was also there's almost no, very few countries that have something that I'm going to say, for those of you listening in 2024, the United States have, with the special representative in the State Department for subnational diplomacy, for an office where Ambassador Nina Chigan sort of manages the relationship between the foreign ministry and its cities. Something like that is so critical today, and so few countries actually have something like that, that we often sort of focus very much on the negotiation piece of COP and not on the fact that the countries themselves need to change and admit that city diplomacy is a piece of what their countries do.
And do you think that, well, how do you see rather the role of cities playing out in future COPs? You know, as they're becoming more kind of center stage, but the UN model is more geared to national government engagement. But do you think that this could change over time?
I've been a half-full glass kind of person. up until now, I sort of, deep in the back of my mind, on the basis of sort of evidence on this, hundreds and hundreds of city networks, thousands of conferences. You can go to an urban conference every other day, hundreds of philanthropic investments with millions and millions, in fact, sort of hundreds of millions of investment. On the one hand, we're at the heyday of city diplomacy. On the other hand, we're confronting quite a nationalist, inward focus backlash in geopolitics in many countries. And even in context where the leadership is perhaps a little bit more progressive or at least left-leaning, there's still quite a sort of looking backwards and inwards. The question is this point in time in the 2020s peak city diplomacy? And we got as far as we could go, because then we would have to admit capacity for a city to actually speak in the multilateral sector. Mm-hmm. We would have to admit capacity for a city, that's the question with the multilateral banks, capacity of a city to receive money directly, not mediated through a counter or third party. We would have to admit that the voice of a city, many cases, not all cases, in many cases, sort of a good quarter of citizens are not nationals, that the mayors and leaders of these cities are appointed by migrants that come from another country as well. So we would have to admit some pretty fundamental shifts in the shell of international relations, right? Sovereignty, mm-hmm. territoriality, citizenships. I like to think that that's likely because of the level of change that cities have created. But I recognize we're facing quite a serious backlash. And I think we need to take it very seriously because it is a, maybe it's not a do or die moment. It's certainly a do or die moment in climate, but it is a critical juncture. Otherwise, we might just get stuck into this mode. Access, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of broader geopolitical challenges which are, yeah, going to have quite a substantial impact, I think, going forward. And although, you know, the role of cities is increasing somewhat in terms of the global kind of climate change stage and negotiations, do you think this is going to impact the how cities can have a, or rather the impact that cities can have on global climate negotiations in terms of their broader influence? I mean, they have been doing getting more involved for the past few years, certainly. But, you know, with these current changes, how do you envisage that's going to impact the ability for cities to influence these sort of negotiations and broader discussions?
It will impact if we don't have a sustained investment by countries in the value of cities. I think that's what's in CHAMP itself. that if there isn't a sustained commitment, especially to cities in the global south, medium and small sized cities, mega cities that represent the majority of a country, if there isn't a sustained commitment to engagement of that, the risk is that the current financial, environmental resilience challenge will eventually push cities to have to choose. Many cities have become more pragmatic on how many of these things they can do at any one time on their own resources, or that we will continuously have to rely, and it's great that we do in many cases, but we will have to rely on philanthropic or private investments to make this happen because we don't have the level of system investment in cities. And that's concerning because that then comes, 98% of philanthropic donation or investments in development are earmarked, so they come with agendas. The private sector has to remain viable financially. So I guess the point is that creates still some important dependencies and some inequalities in the system. And I think for me, that's a critical one, because if we don't invest in this, the inequalities that will continue and might become starker are inequalities in the front of a climate crisis, major urban health issues, really pressing resilience challenges. So cities is really the front line in many, many cases here.
Mm-hmm. And as national governments sort of develop their own ambitious climate plans, how can they best support national government to deliver on their own climate commitments, especially if there is instability in terms of climate finance and accessing that climate finance, particularly for, cities in the global south that are more vulnerable to the changing impacts of climate change?
Yeah, I think on that front, you first of all have the interesting movement to better structure internally central local relations. So having capacity for the engagement of cities in the creation of national plans. There's a growing reality, and the OECD has done really great work on this, the growing reality of national urban plans and national urban policies. That is a positive movement because you have countries recognizing the need to work with urban issues and the two things talking to each other. There is a good enough but not as well structured variety of sort of central local relation systems, but many times it's splintered, for instance, or it doesn't really have a specific ministry to deal with and so on. So there's a little bit of organizing and there's a little bit of capacity to be recognized nationally. I think that the interesting thing for me is where then there's an additional step on that, which is embedding cities into national planning, embedding the voice of cities. Because the big shift, we did a piece of work on the UN frameworks, which is quite matching the national frameworks and national policies. The recognition of cities since 1972 to today has grown across all kinds of areas, across all kinds of domains, and that where the recognition has grown the most is in recognizing cities as actors. And there's a big difference between saying a city or an urban thing is a place where something happens and a city is an actor that can do something. So the importance of recognizing nationally cities as key actors is critical. But at times cities are going one way politically and countries are going the opposite way.
Yeah, and I think we're going to probably see more of that next year. Not naming names. Well, thank you so much, Professor Kito, for your time and for your insights, not only on COP 29, but on the kind of broader opportunities and complexities of city collaborations. It's been great to discuss that with you. So thank you.
Thanks, Catherine. A pleasure.
Thank you for listening. In our next episode, we'll be speaking with Councillor Susan Aitken, leader of Glasgow City Council, on the role that climate finance can play enabling cities to reach their climate targets.